This is the 50th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother John Popel on The King Who Fell. This is the third talk in his series. The subtitle for today is Lilies, Myrrh, and Doves. This is the third talk in his series. The introductory reading is Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verses 1 to 7, and chapter 7, 1 to 9.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, if I could get some assistance from... Ah, he's run away. No, you haven't. No, I know. If we need a conductor, I know where to turn. Kyria, can you kill the lights there? All four switches. One, two. Perfect. Thank you very much. That allows you to see that a little better. Thank you, Andrew, for that introductory reading. The title this morning, my apologies to Alan, I got everything jumbled up, and the title this morning is Siren Song of Lebanon. So over these next two talks, what we're going to do is take our attempts to grab hold of the whole song, to see it in its wholeness, and we'll be looking at the structure and the storyline today, and tomorrow we're going to try and solve the symbols. We just took a reading, and we read from two sections, both of which were a description from Solomon of his beloved Lebanese bride. So, you're all sat there relaxed and ready to listen. Too late. It's a test. Early morning test for you. Who's had their coffee? What was the signature difference between the two descriptions that we read? One from chapter 4, one from chapter 7. Ah, there you go. You didn't expect that, did you? Wow, smart observation, yes. What was the difference in the towers? That wasn't the one I was looking for. You're absolutely right.
One was David and one was
Lebanon. Yeah, the tower that she was compared to started off as David and ended up as Lebanon. That's absolutely critical. We're coming to that. So that's a wonderful answer. Thank you.
What's?
Yeah, did you notice that? He describes her in chapter 4 from the top downwards. And then he describes her in chapter 7 from the bottom upwards. Isn't that interesting? What does that mean? Let's have a look. So anyway, that's this little tantalizing intro. Bear those thoughts in mind. We're going to need both of those thoughts later. So where do we get to? We've identified the main characters of the song, Solomon the king and his Lebanese bride, and we found the very many verses that substantiate this from within the text of the scripture. It's not an overlay we've created ourselves. So that's all good. And we move ahead to just maybe a little plot summary here. He is Israel's spiritual leader, and she, being Lebanese, does not know Israel's God. Little correction, in case I accidentally misled anyone yesterday, certainly the summary in the Wayfarer is accurate, but I may have confused a couple of people. When I'm making comparisons to Abishag the Shunammite of this girl here, I'm saying there's a definite comparison of type. But I'm not trying to say that the girl in the song is actually Abishag. So if I left anyone with that impression, I apologize. That was me misspeaking. She doesn't know Israel's God. She's from Lebanon, part of the unconquered territory. Their mutual love is genuine. I'm not at any point going to try and suggest that there's something malicious or manipulative going on from either party to either other party, intentionally at least. They're genuinely in love with each other. He becomes infatuated with her. As we'll see, he changes nationality. We'll actually watch that happen. And his leadership role transfers to her. We're going to see that happen. You can understand why he's in a leadership role, not just because he's in a culture where the husband would leave the wife, but he is actually king pretty much of the known world. The Israeli Empire at that time controlled just about everything. That was given to him by God, not because he was a great man, but because his father was. God said, for your father's sake, I will allow you to have that eminence. There's no mention of God. Now that's his responsibility. It's not her fault that she doesn't mention a God she doesn't know, but it is his fault that he doesn't bring to the forefront of his life an attempt to introduce into her life the God of his father David. So as a consequence, she becomes deadly. not because she's trying to kill him, but she's someone that he's in love with, and he has no source of life, or no source of God. We have a...
Battery for you.
Yep, I think we have a failing battery, not just mine, but also the one in the little box there. I'm just going to soldier on, and we'll see how we go. My voice may go up and down. And we now can understand that if that is true, then that would explain the dynamics with the support characters we've seen. We will see some tension between the female character, the Lebanese bride, and the daughters of Jerusalem, because they are the ones who should have been in her place, so that you can understand she's being resentful, they're being resentful of that. And we can understand why, if the watchmen of Jerusalem are doing their job properly and are clear-sighted, they are seeing their king begin to undergo spiritual collapse because of his love for the woman. So whilst the woman is essentially guiltless, it's still going to be their job to try and remove her from his sphere of influence so that the king stays as a good spiritual leader of the people of Jerusalem. The king and the bride are married. Most of the modern commentators will suggest that that's not the case, and they'll point out that it's pretty clear that Solomon and the bride clearly don't live in the same place, because he goes to her palace at some points. But I think what they're missing there is a good knowledge of the scripture, because we know that whilst almost every man and his wife will live together in the same building, that wasn't true for Solomon. As you may remember, Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David to the palace he had built for her, for he said, "My wife must not live in the palace of David, king of Israel, because the places the ark of the Lord has entered are holy." So it's an astonishing realization that in the case of Pharaoh's daughter anyway, another of Solomon's wives, he'd realized she can't come into the city of David and live with me here, because she's not actually worshipping the same God. But for some reason, he still thought the marriage was fine. He'd just build her a palace outside of the place of David. Here then is the summary of Solomon's spiritual collapse. We know it happened for real because it's detailed in the book of 1 Kings. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter: Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from the nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. I'll be coming back to that statement. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. So it was his love for his wives that influenced him to turn away from God. Notice even the text of the scripture there does not in itself blame the wives, it blames his love for the wives, his determination that he would do everything to serve them, including worshipping their gods. Why did Solomon have so many wives? I don't know if you've heard, but have you heard the sort of general idea drifting around that was in my head from an early time? That it was because he was politically very shrewd and was making stable alliances with the countries nearby. Has anyone kind of heard that sort of idea? I always had that in my head, and I never really challenged it. But the first time I turned and stopped to challenge it, I realized that can't possibly be true. How many countries surround Israel? Four? Five? Even at that time. Throw in a few sort of local baronies, perhaps. 10? At max, where'd the other 990 wives come from? So this was not the reason. And nor does the Bible, more importantly, nor does the Bible say it's all because of Solomon's shrewd political acumen that he ended up with these relationships. Nor does the Bible leave us guessing. It says explicitly, Solomon fell in love. Time and time and time again. Times 1,000. It was his emotional weakness, despite his great intellectual wisdom, that destabilized his own faith and thereby destabilized the very country that he was supposed to be leading. So if you hear again that these alliances Solomon had were all to do with some sort of shrewd political maneuvering, think again. I think the Bible flatly contradicts it. You don't have to trust me. I wouldn't. But I would trust certainly what the scripture describes as the cause for the collapse. And so there's... yeah, that's good. The great things online. Let's remind ourselves of this one verse that speaks of the number of wives that he has at this particular time of writing. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number. But my dove, my perfect one, is unique. Now, those numbers may not be absolutely exact, but around about 140 partners he has at the moment. So if he has 140 partners, what does that tell us? That she's what? That he's a busy boy. Yes, it's true enough. He's about to get a lot busier. That's was the point I was looking for. It means there's about 800 odd still to come, right? Yes. Well said. So, in complete violation of the law of the Lord in Deuteronomy 17. Do not amass horses, do not amass wives, do not amass gold. So never mind that it violates the law. What does the fact of 860 partners still to come tell you about the relationship that you're reading about in the song right now? It doesn't last. So whereas you might have been invited to consider this as the ultimate love song, it is definitely a description of intense, genuine, loving passion. It doesn't last. She's the perfect one. She's unique for now. But when a few hundred more women come into the harem, how do you think she's left feeling then? What? Hey, hi, perfect one here. Unique dove over here, appear to be some new arrivals. Who are they? And I'm sort of making fun, but it's actually very poignant, isn't it? So this thing that we're reading about truly is a description of Solomon's folly. Because what seemed to be such a beautiful moment of intense and surely permanent love was as permanent as a dream. This relationship doesn't last. And I think it tells us something else that is useful. There's a lot of intellectual and academic argument over the dating, that the time period, I mean, of the song, when it was written. And a lot of study has gone into the forms of the Hebrew words. And Solomon lived in the 10th century BC, but many who look at the Hebrew suggest that the Hebrew betrays forms which have a more Aramaic influence and might have come a little bit later. I'm not qualified to make intelligent commentary on that. I can tell you that the number of centuries over which the song is proposed to have been written vary by as many as 7 centuries, from anywhere from the 10th century BC to the 3rd century BC, with many expositors choosing the 6th century BC by reason of the language. However, I myself really see the spiritual power of the song as something that Solomon really needs to learn from and recover from. So I honestly think it is written by Solomon in the time of Solomon. And this verse is something of a giveaway. If I were to even go out into the world and say, Solomon, women, give me a number, anyone with even a cursory familiarity of Scripture would say 1,000. Solomon was the 1,000-woman man. That's the briefest summary you can give. So if there's a verse saying, I am Solomon, the 140-woman man, you realize we're talking at a specific point in his life. So I suggest that is actually dating the song more explicitly and more accurately than any study of potential Aramaic and Hebrew forms might be able to do for us. So I think this helps put the chronology of the song around about the time of Solomon's reign. Let's look at the actual structure of the written piece. Give me just a second. I think there's a weakness here. You don't want to look at it? What about me? Should I just turn around? Yeah, that's right. Are we functional? Is that right? Oh, maybe, sort of. Here's a word, chiasmus, or a chiastic structure. Is that something that's familiar to many of you? Yeah. I suggest to you, it's definitely familiar to all of you. You may not know the word, but in actual fact, the idea of a chiastic structure is something that should be very familiar to all of you. Let me show you a picture of one. That, for example, is one of the best illustrations one can give of a chiastic structure. I may actually have to give up on this, Tom. It's kind of gone. I'll talk loud. Can you still hear me at the back? I don't know what this does for the purposes of the recording, but that's going to be less distracting, at least to me. This is a great example of a chiasmus. If I were to ask you, there are 4, 8, 10 people in this photograph. If I were to ask you who are the two most important people in this photograph, you already know the answer. Okay? How is that portrayed to us? Because they're not different from any other people. The point is, these people are arranged in a symmetric and anti-symmetric structure in order to emphasize the people in the middle. That's what a chiasmus is. It exists in literature, but this is a better way to see it because you can literally see it. So on the one side, there's female, 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 female. On the other side, there's male, 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 male. And through that anti-symmetry, you highlight the presence of the couple, the male and the female, in the middle. That's how chiasmus works, okay? So if I talk about porcupines, leopards, elephants, leopards, and porcupines, I actually give an emphasis to the elephant in the middle because I've created a structure leading up to it from either side. That's not the only way it works by gender here, you can probably see. Look at the dress code. The dress code here with the ladies is blue, 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 white. And with the gentleman, it's almost identical. It's this gray or black with a blue tie, black and blue, black and blue, black and blue, black and blue, black and white. So you can see even the dress code also gives you a chiasmus. And the nice thing here, which is subtle, is that the difference between the groom's dress and his groomsman is quite subtle. It's hard to spot immediately. Whereas the difference between the bridesmaid's dress code and the bride is very, very striking. And so what that suggests, again, just visually and very beautifully, is saying, actually, the bride is actually even more important than the groom. Which is the basis of... No, it's not. Which is actually, culturally, our basis, the Western culture's basis, of at least the wedding day. It's her day even more than it's his day, in that sense. And so that's a very sort of visual way to bring that truth about. And some even arrange their groomsmen and bridesmaids, it hasn't really been done here, sometimes even in order of ascending height, as if to downplay their importance as actual characters. They are merely support structures to the two in the middle. So there's actually potentially three different chiastic structures here, all with the same purpose, to emphasize and highlight the elevated importance of the central component. So that's something you're very familiar with. You notice that at a glance, you know exactly what's going on. The word may be new, but the idea and the concept is well known to all of us. It's used in literature as well. People write poems, and sometimes even prose, according to chiastic structures. Why is that relevant? Well, without surprise, the Song of Songs is written quite clearly as a chiasmus, as an entirety, as a chiastic structure. As a consequence, there is a central verse. And whilst there may be a central couplet phrase to any of the books of the Bible, that doesn't necessarily have any meaning to it. However, if the book is arranged as a chiasmus, and I will try and justify that, then it does. That makes this, in a way, the center verse, the most important summary of the song. This is just a personal testimony, but as it happens, before I knew that, I'd selected this verse to be a summary of the song. I had no idea it was the centre verse, and I had no idea that the song I had yet to discover was arranged chiastically. So that was a delightful corroboration for me. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. We haven't translated that yet, but what we'll find is that comes to be a description of the sexual union of the couple. That is the focal point around which this song is composed. And everything before that verse is prior to that event, and everything after that verse is subsequent to that event. So we have a linear chronology from start to finish, from chapter 1 to chapter 8, but in terms of importance of events, we have two halves. It's a book of two halves centered around this focal crux. Let's start justifying this so you don't have to just take it on my allegation. We have a very simple chiasmus here between mountains and towers. We speak about, so the chapters will always be linear, 2, 4, 7, 8, and 5, 1, that verse will always be in the middle. We speak about mountains and speak about towers, and then speak about towers and speak about mountains. That's the sort of bridesmaid and groomsman style ordinary chiasmus that comes highlighting the focal attention onto the center verse. But there's a little bit more than that. We have those two poems describing the woman. There's a special word for that too. It's called a wasif, when you have a poem which describes by sequence elements that come along. So these two poems, as we noted, one is from the top down, describing the woman. The other starts at the feet and goes from the feet upwards. And so they're anti-symmetric, but as anti-symmetric, chapter 4 on this side and chapter 7 on that side, they too form a focal point that points at that center verse. And not only that, but we have geographical calls to come and to go. Solomon will call his bride away from Lebanon towards Jerusalem, and then in the very last verse of the entire piece, she ends the piece by calling him away from Jerusalem. A call towards Jerusalem from Lebanon, a call away from Jerusalem. An anti-symmetric structure there. And at the same time, we notice that centered around this focal point in the middle, there are times when he leads, and they are always and only before that center verse, and there are times when she leads, and they are always and only after that center verse. So there's more to it than that, but I don't want to make this slide unnecessarily jumbled. There's at least four different types of chiasmus that point to the structuring of that poem. What have we learned, therefore? It's arranged very carefully. This is a work of God. This isn't an arbitrary anthology of scraps of poetry thrown together at the hand of man. We've learned this is a book of two halves. And the two halves are not fully symmetric. The first half is going to be very, very different in tone, opposite, in fact, from the second half. That's where the spiritual weight is going to come in. This is not a literary class. We're not interested in literary structures per se, except where they serve to set up a good way to deliver spiritually valuable information. Let's break down each of these four chiastic structures separately and look at the spiritual weight that lies behind them. The center verse, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. There's a before and there's an afterwards. And before, what we see over that center point is a transfer of leadership from before to afterwards. So before, he leads and only he leads. Come with me, he says in chapter 2, verse 10. And verse 13, and chapter 4, verse 8. But afterwards, that's the period where she will lead. She invites him. This verse is entirely coupled. It's next to this one. This is the invitation that leads to the crux. And thereafter, come, she says. She's now leading him. Come away, she says. Come into, come away. Either way, notice the person issuing the leadership directives has changed from him to her. And it's changed around the fact of their sexual union. Afterwards, he is sufficiently smitten. He is no longer in control. and she leads because of his susceptibility of love for women. A call away from Lebanon before and a call away from Jerusalem afterwards. This isn't just symmetry and anti-symmetry. This is spiritually massive because Jerusalem has importance. Jerusalem is the apple of God's eye. He leads her towards Jerusalem, but he's not strong enough to maintain that directive, and ultimately she will lead him away from the city that is the apple of God's eye and which he should be leading. Okay? So there's one of those, a couple of those structures. Let's look at the mountains. Before there were mountains, afterwards there were mountains. Great. But they're very different mountains. Beforehand, they were the mountains of Bethel. I don't know a lot about them, except to know they are within the territory of Judah, south of Jerusalem. Afterwards, were they mountains of Judah? No. They were mountains of spices. Now, tomorrow we're going to do a much more rigorous analysis and translation of the symbols, but for now, it's not unreasonable. You're probably familiar with the idea that phrases such as the spice of life and such like are indicative that spices are representative of pleasures. So before it was the mountains of Judah, but afterwards he celebrates on the mountains of pleasures. Brothers and sisters, let me just run a brief aside, which I think is important. The idea that mountains, this could have been conveyed by any feature and the argument would remain the same. Mountains is especially relevant because I think it can be shown that mountains represent ruling powers within the scriptures. Is that an idea with which anyone's familiar? Or okay, good. I'll spend one slide just for those who are new to that idea or skeptical, right, skeptical of anything you might not have heard of before. Look at some of the passages that talk about mountains in the scripture, and it's clear it can't be literal mountains that are mentioned, and it's further clear it's talking about the ruling power of the time. Here's a very ironic one, because this is talking about the coronation of the new king. And who's the new king who's being crowned here? Solomon, ironically. And David writes, "Endow my son, the king, Solomon, with your justice, O God, the royal son with your righteousness. He will judge your people in righteousness, your afflicted ones with justice. The mountains will bring prosperity to the people, the hills the fruit of righteousness." So it's written as a parallelism. The king and the government, the mountains and the hills. That is an equation between the two. The mountain represents the ruling power. Similarly, when Jesus speaks of the chaotic times of the end, the time will come, says Jesus, when you will say, "Blessed are the barren women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed." Then they will say to the mountains, "Fall on us," and to the hills, "Cover us." So in times of great distress, this is not talking about people will run up to the hills and find a novel way to commit suicide by saying, "Mountain, jump on top of me." It's nothing to do with literality. They will go to their governments and to their ruling powers and say, "Protect us." And that's happening a lot in the world right now, particularly actually in the country where I live, in the United States, where there's a great deal of fear, perhaps the strongest country on earth, and perhaps also, ironically, the most fearful, where there's a great deal of people crying out to their government, "You should protect us against fears both real and imagined." "But the rock that struck the statue," this is the vision of Nebuchadnezzar's image, "became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth." Who was the rock? Jesus, we know that. And what does Jesus become? He becomes a huge kingdom that fills the whole earth. So there again is a direct parallel between mountain and kingdom. All right? So that slide is supposed to achieve one thing, to justify the idea that mountain means a ruling power. So if that's true, when we look back at the last slide, there was a ruling power in Solomon's life that was Judah. That's now much deeper and more impactful. And yet after his union with his new bride, there was a ruling power in Solomon's life that was pleasure. So there's a lot encoded in this simple song. The sequential poems that we looked at, the Wasifs is their special name, there are two of them, from as he describes them, one before the center verse and one afterwards. There's the one before, chapter 4, verses 1 to 7, and there's the one afterwards, chapter 7, verses 1 to 9. Somewhat familiar because Brother Andrew kindly read them for us this morning. And The first thing you notice just by looking at the screen, really, is, well, one of these poems describes the woman only from her head as far as her torso, whereas the other poem describes the entirety of her body. Do you think there's a message latent within that? I think that might be a very subtle and a very gentle way to actually reveal the fact that their relationship is consummated. I was familiar with her at some level and partially beforehand. Now I am familiar with all of her body and all of her being. So I think that's just a rather gentle, nice, poetic way to show the additional physical intimacy which has been shared in that center point. But of critical importance, and as our brother has already spotted, look at the direction of the description. In the first wasif, it is the eyes, the hair, the cheeks, the teeth, other facial elements, from there all the way down to her breasts. In other words, it goes from the top downwards. But in the second poem, in the second wasif, then the elements that are described are the feet, the thighs, the navel, the waist, the breasts, it's like a collarbone, I don't know what's going on. And it goes upwards all the way up to the top of her head, and then finishes, I think, with a return to her breasts and her lips, which presumably is just a flourish emphasizing the sexual motif. But clearly the direction overall is from the bottom upwards. What then does that represent? What do you think? One starts with thinking in terms of, oh, that's interesting, I hadn't thought of that. That might be the case. But then I'm unsure what the other would be starting with.
A full knowledge?
I'm sorry?
A full knowledge?
A full knowledge. I think that is conveyed by the extent of the poems. I totally agree with that. That's the point I have here. I think that where there was a partial sharing, now there is a fullness of sharing. I think so. I wonder if you'd be prepared to accept that I think that is a clever depiction of the transfer of power. When he looks at her, and I don't mean this in any demeaning sense, and as a male, he's probably taller than her, he looks and he sees the top of her head. He looks down on her. I don't mean that in a bad way. And he sees her from the top of her head downwards before. But for some reason, after their union, he's on eye level with her feet, isn't he? The first thing he sees is her feet, which means one of two things has happened. Either he's made her in his mind into an image 90 feet tall, a la Nebuchadnezzar's golden image, or, equally simply, he is prostrate at her feet, metaphorically, and he is looking, and the first thing he sees is her feet, and to see the rest of her, he has to look upwards. He used to look down on her, I don't mean that in derogatory sense, he used to look down on her. Now he looks up on her. Is that fair to say that's a pretty elegant, poetic way to describe a transfer of power? And that's what I think the poetry maintains in seeing the elements going from the top downwards in the first wasif and then from the bottom upwards in the second. So there's very clever and subtle uses of language that describe something with actual spiritual meaning. And then there's this spiritual immigration, I like to call it, or this change of nationality that quite clearly appears either side of chapter 5, verse 1. And our brother actually pointed out that he noted those two elements within the two wasifs. It's to do with the towers, and it's to do with the way they praise each other. Look at this. He praises her. Solomon says to the bride, "Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance." So he wants to praise her, and he thinks of things of King David, things of Israel. Because things of Israel are beautiful to him. And if he wants to call her beautiful, he makes allusion to those things he finds beautiful. Then she is praising him. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as its cedars. So there's no actual intentional warfare going on here, but in order for her to compliment him, she draws from her own natural knowledge of what she finds beautiful. She finds the cedars of Lebanon beautiful. So she praises him in that sense. So although they genuinely are in love with each other, there is somewhat of a natural mismatch in what they're calling beautiful. So in this unintentional conflict, how does it bear out? We've gone from chapter 4 to chapter 5. In chapter 7, he praises her again. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking towards Syria. And so, wait a minute, wasn't it the Tower of David that represented things that were beautiful? Yes, it was in time past. But now, in the second half, it's the Tower of Lebanon, just like the cedars of Lebanon. He has actually come over to her side, and now they both agree on what's where the elements of beauty lie, and they lie in Lebanon. And David, King David, and his God are somewhat forgotten. This is how he describes himself there for him. And now, at all times, in green there, you'll see those chapter numbers. So glance at the chapter number, not because you need to look it up, but because it'll tell you whether you're in the first half of the book, 1 through 4, where he's leading and Israel still has some preeminence, or whether you're in the second half of the book, where clearly Lebanon is leading and she's leading, and Israel and Israel's God have been forgotten. Your hair is like royal tapestry, says Solomon. The king is held captive by its tresses. He says, I'm captured. How ironic that a theory exists, or at least to exist, about the king holding the girl captive. The text itself says, the reverse is true. I'm the captive, says the king. I am caught up in her long, beautiful hair. I am mesmerized by her. Earlier on, right from the beginning, the bride had essentially said, with no malice aforethought, while the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. And you have this image of something intoxicating emanating from her from the very beginning that enables that. The king describes himself as captive and mesmerized. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bat Rabim. Well, that's interesting, and there's a lot of geographical references thrown in there, and the interesting thing is some of them are real places and some of them aren't. So Heshbon is a real place, Bat Rabim is not. And so what I do is I look where the real place is, and if it's not a real place, I just translate the Hebrew. Heshbon is in Moab. That's unfortunate, so that's outside the land of Israel as well. Bet Rabim, of course, just means Beth Rabim, the house of rabbis. So if you translate that, he is taking leadership. The rabbi in his house is in her eyes. He is taking leadership from what she sees as right. Okay, there's a lot of subtlety here. This one is a little easier. This is a little more obvious. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. Well, anyone with a slight familiarity with farming, it is the farmer who brands the cattle, not the cattle who brands the farmer. So ownership is the one who places the seal, and the owned is the one who wears the seal. She places the seal, he wears it. She's the farmer, he's the cattle. And that's not necessarily a morally wrong thing, it just indicates the degree of ownership. We hope ourselves to wear a brand, don't we? The angels put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. God places the seal, and we hope he places his seal on us. We wear the seal. He is God, we are God's followers. She is his God, he is her follower. It's very clear from the seal right there in the final chapter. And as a consequence, therefore, I think with that backdrop, we can now see why there is a strong comparison, without any guilt associated on her part, between the language used in the song to describe her and the language used in Proverbs 7 to describe the intoxicating but ultimately lethally dangerous woman. There came out a woman to meet him, this is Proverbs, dressed like a prostitute and with crafty intent. Stop to remind yourself who wrote the Proverbs, if you would like an extra helping of irony to go with your Bible study. She is unruly and defiant. Her feet never stay at home, now in the street, now in the squares. Excuse me. At every corner she lurks. I have covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let's drink deeply of love till morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. This is the language of the prostitute of Proverbs 7. And the bride has these phrases. All night long on my bed I look for the one my heart loves. I looked but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city through its streets and squares. And it's the same Hebrew clause used here as is used here, even though the English has been translated with a slightly different meter. It's the same clause exactly. Is that the only similarity? No. I've covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots, horses. You remind me of something about Egypt, says Solomon. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Our bed is verdant, she says. My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to browse in the gardens, and fill our bed with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, myrrh and aloes. Come, let's drink deeply of love till morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not at home, and he speaks, until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. So his mountain, his ruling power, will be myrrh. We'll translate the symbol of myrrh tomorrow. But it doesn't have a happy thought. And remember, this is that rare use outside of the song of the Hebrew verb dodim that speaks of that very special and necessarily sexual love. In fact, so much so that their love is said in at least three places to be more important than wine. When Jesus introduced the symbol of wine, what did Jesus say wine represented? His blood. And in the Old Testament, what was it that blood represented? The blood is?
Blood.
So what is wine? Life. This love is more important than life. That's a rather dark statement, isn't it? Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than life. We rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than life. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than life. This is a deadly love. Neither intends to harm the other, but this is a deadly love. Does the song go on to support that concept? This love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. Now you might say, well, look, it's only trying to use death as an example of something which is strong, and death is very strong. That's all it's trying to say. True, but I've never yet seen a Hallmark greeting card decide to use that particular motif on one of their Valentine's Day's offerings. And given that it's taken from the Song of Songs, which is sometimes thought to be the world's greatest love song, why wouldn't they? Because it's not talking about a love that will lead to life. It's as clear as day. This love has been taken in supersession to life, and it will lead to the grave. This is the last chapter. The allusion is very clear. There is repeated emphasis that this particular love will be deadly. Here's a last little thought, a little detail, which gave me a little tingle down the spine when I saw it. I really enjoyed this one. 60 queens there may be, and further numbers in the book. And it suddenly struck me, because 60 isn't a particularly common number, biblically speaking, right? It's not a 7 or a 12 or a 40, which come up all over the place and probably have quite clear meanings to them. But where else have I seen the number 60? I saw it in the song. You're absolutely right, Mary. Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 bodyguards, warriors, prepared for the terrors of the night. 60 queens. 60 bodyguards. Coincidence? It might be, but I think the song is written far more carefully than that. The song is trying to point out where the danger lies. The danger lies with those very queens with whom Solomon keeps falling in love. So the song furnishes him with 60 bodyguards, and yet in reality, they stand guard in vain. Where were they standing? I don't know, but presumably around the palace. But for Solomon, spiritually, the terrors of the night were never outside of his own bed. The warrior stood guard outside against terrors that weren't coming from outside. Solomon had created his own deadly disaster, and he had taken it quite literally into his own bed. And what beautiful poignance there is just in these very soft allusions for the careful reader to discover of what's really happening in this song. And notice today, brothers and sisters, just how many times we've been using the literal text of the song to explain itself. So let's wrap up today's study. What have we learned? We've learned, I think, one of the most important life lessons we can take for the modern age, that love can be intense enough to replace God if faith is weak. And even love which is pure and feels right can be fatal if it displaces God. Why is that a particularly useful lesson for our community, and particularly perhaps the young people in our community who will hear this same class in several moments' time? Because occasionally perhaps we've stumbled, we who try and lead the community, or we who are teachers and parents, because, and I've seen this handed out as Sunday school material, descriptions of the characteristics of godly people. And there are a list of godly characteristics. And then there's a description of characteristics of worldly people. And it says, if you go out in the world, everyone you meet will be materialistic and greedy and hateful and spiteful and ungrateful and deadly. And that caricature isn't true. And as long as we feed that caricature, then our young people will go out into this world and meet people who are lovely, who are genuinely altruistic and loving and giving and humble. And they'll say, wow, everything I learned at church was nonsense. This person's wonderful. Where then is the lesson in the Bible that says, be careful? Even a wonderful, true, mutual, altruistic, self-sacrificing love can be deadly. I'll tell you where. It's the Song of Songs. We mustn't overlook it any longer. We shouldn't create caricature demons out of worldly people. Yes, there are people who are greedy and materialistic and hateful and spiteful in the world. Sadly, are we saying our community is entirely devoid of those aspects? We know it's not. The point is not that there is some magical divide between those within our church community and those outside. The point is, you need God, and you mustn't let go of God. God is the source of life, and love that has God is a love that leads to an even greater form of life. And love can be wonderful in experience in its own self, but without God, it's going to lead us to the mountains of myrrh, as the song will very clearly demonstrate. How could love ever cost me my faith, I fight back. If I believe truth, won't truth beat error? What sort of error will derail the truth that I know to be true? Tell me that. And the answer is, there is no error that will defeat truth, but I deceive myself if I think I always value the quest for truth more than the celebration of pleasure. The danger is within the strength of faith. Truth will always stand up, but people will often just say, well, I don't need truth for now. This is too enjoyable, too wonderful, too lovely to let go. There's the danger, my brothers and sisters, and it's spelled out so clearly and so beautifully in that chiastic Song of Songs. So tomorrow, we get to a very exciting stage. We've looked at the structure and the storyline of the song to some extent. We'll need to do some more detailed work. But at no point so far have we made any genuine concerted effort to find a biblical translation for the symbols that pervade the song. And as long as that's true, we haven't really expounded the song in its fullness. So tomorrow's job is nice and simple and straightforward as an independent inquiry. What do these symbols mean? We're going to try and find biblical answers for the symbols, and then, here's the fun part, we reread the verses where the symbols show up using the different words and see what's said. There's some quite revelatory things. coming up tomorrow. I'm excited, and I hope you are too. Thank you very much, Brother Arnold.